amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. I'm sat here with Steve D. We're ready to talk about stuff that's been going on this week in the investing world, the stock market, and in general other bits of our lives, to be honest. I'm quite excited this week. I like the look of our show, and there's been some interesting things happening for me away from the markets. But first of all, you, Steve, how are you doing? How's your week been?
Not too bad, Steve. It's been another very busy week at work, so I've not had a lot of time to look at my portfolio, but was pleased to see last night when I finally got a chance to have a good look at it that it was up about 1.5% on the week, which is always something to smile about. I've been paid as well, so I've added about £600 in. It's just sat in a money market fund at the moment, and that's obviously not included in the value because I'm too lazy to update Google Finance with the money market fund, and because it's at about 7,000 decimal places. But Steve, you've had a very interesting week, so I'll let you chime in. What's happened to
you? Sure. My portfolio is actually up 1.6 or so percent. It's been a really interesting week. I'll come to the big news in a minute, but so on the portfolio side, I just had a quick scan through what's been going on here, and I'm like you, have mixed feelings when things go up, right? I tend to want to buy them more, which means I like them at lower prices, at least in this part of the investing journey. But I'm up by 1.6%, and the big gains, but most of that appears to have come from things that I wasn't really planning on buying anyway. So Southern Copper is up about 5%, Apple is up about 6%, Amazon is up about 3 or 4%. Together, that makes up roughly, call it, 25% of my portfolio. That's pushing things along. None of those three were really front and center on my list of stocks to buy, though, so they haven't kind of flown out of range. I probably wasn't really buying any of these at these prices anyway. The stuff that I had an eye on and was looking at adding to, and still am looking at adding to as and when dividends come in, still all in reasonably where it was territory, which is sort of fairly heavily in the red. I don't really mind that, to be honest, but looking to buy some more stuff. So I suppose I should be pleased, and I should now think about selling the overpriced stuff to buy the underpriced stuff, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to fiddle with it. Next week, I'll tell you I've done nothing at all. I did nearly nothing this week, just reinvested some dividend stuff. Big news this week is that for the first time, I have become an uncle this time. My sister-in-law.
Congratulations.
Thank you. My sister-in-law has given birth. She's got a little baby girl. They're doing quite well. It was a couple of days ago now. Just on the final day of August, so just sneaking into being the very youngest person in the school year above, rather than the very oldest person in the school year below by about 7 minutes. I'm also an August birthday, so I have some empathy with being down the younger end of the school age spectrum. But my sister-in-law's, well, my niece as she now is, will be one of the youngest in her school when the time comes.
Very nice, very nice. Good news that, Steve. Congratulations again. We had a 4D scan
uncle,
on Sunday.
Right,
I don't think I've actually told you. I already am, yeah. I am an uncle. One, two, three times now. So
oh, wow.
I'm sure I'm not forgetting it. Sure I'm not forgetting any there. So we had a 4D scan on Sunday, Steve. It was very interesting. Baby had legs either side of her head, and then we had to go for a 2.5 hour walk, which was not in a very nice part of Hull, so we ended up getting in the car and going for lunch on the marina. We came back, and the baby had arms in front of her head, but that was actually the third time we've gone, so we were like, come on, just do your best, I really don't want to come back here again. So we've got quite a lot of, well, they gave us 52 pictures and videos of the
wow.
baby on this 4D scan, and look, this was not for me. They look like mud monsters. It's frightening to look at. Some of the pictures we got, Steve, are terrifying. And if I remember, I'll put some in for people on the video because they're so bad. They're so bad. But they don't even look like they don't look like anything. It just looks like a tree trunk. But anyway, Laura's over the moon with them, so we will just live with it. But yeah, did you though, Steve? Did you watch Yorkshire last night? Absolutely thrash New Zealand.
I didn't watch Yorkshire thrash New Zealand last night. I haven't watched Yorkshire do anything recently. But yeah, no, I take your point. We've started both T20s quite well so far now, I think. Both pretty comprehensive stuff. New Zealand are playing without Kane Williamson, who is arguably their best player in any format. Probably their best player in T20. Maybe, maybe not for that. But at any rate, he's very good and he's well in there. And
you two have Moran, then not. Yeah.
Yeah, he's part of their strongest team, right? And an important part of it. But this is convincing looking stuff from England. And we're approaching a World Cup for this, right? We're always approaching some or other World Cup. There's World Cups for like nearly every format now. Being optimistic, Steve?
Yeah, if they can keep the Yorkshire boys fit and healthy, Steve, we've got a very good chance of winning this one. I mean, watching Brook and Bairstow yesterday, it started off a little bit tentative, but then it just ended up being a master blast, didn't it? And I mean, Brook was doing the two fingers up kind of routine, and then he started playing a load of silly shots as well. And what did he end up with, 60 something, and, mm-hmm. and Bairstow ended up with 80 something as well, 80 not out, I think. Bairstow batted all the way through, I think. So this New Zealand side looks weak, Steve, without Kane Williamson, doesn't it? It looks like they're missing the talisman, maybe. But it'd be interesting to see how we do against others.
Yeah, they've always been a kind of conglomerate team, New Zealand, by which I mean more than the sum of their parts, right? They've never had many really outstanding cricketers. They've had some going back, but they've always played better than you would think looking at their play. You match yourself up 1-11 against them and think, I don't know as I want more than two of these, to be honest, for our team. But they've always kind of historically played quite well, and no doubt they will again. But this was this is fairly one-sided stuff at the moment. I wonder about that a little bit. I mean, I look at our one-day team, and the bowling unit doesn't massively inspire me with this. So I'm looking at Gus Atkinson, Bryden Carse, bits and pieces from Livingston. It's rapid, Gus Atkinson, gets it down there in a hurry. But I don't know. I kind of think that seems to be the main reason he's been selected, rather than he actually takes any wickets for Surrey. Because he, I think, does sort of okay. He got four against New Zealand, though, so hard for me to argue with that in bowling them out for 103 in whatever it was, about 16 overs or something. So
a lot of runs to get.
Yeah.
A lot of runs to get. It's intimidating sometimes, isn't it?
And I get that in this kind of thing, chasing 200 thereabouts, there's no point losing by 20. You might as well lose by 60. When you get to 8 down, paddling your way up to what, cut the deficit to 40-odd rather than 80-odd. What is the point of batting another 6 overs here? But, yeah, good impressive stuff from England. We're in, let's say, maybe the next stage down. Cricket for me, we're final week of the season here, Steve, and all three of our teams still have stuff to play for. Our first have got themselves out the relegation zone last week. Our seconds have got themselves into the promotion places last week, and our thirds are currently balancing on the edge of a promotion place. They are not in it, but a win and the other results going their way could put them in the last week of the season. So lots to play for here. It's exciting last week of the season. I'm always sad, though, last week of the cricket season. I quite like cricket season. Always want it to continue a little bit longer. Weather forecast for this week looks predictably pretty amazing around here.
Yeah, we've had a pretty crappy summer for cricket as well. I mean, over here, we've the team that I used to play for that I've now properly retired from, they've had quite a lot. I think nearly half of their games rain affected in some way or the other, and it looks like from at least through September we're gonna have some decent weather. So it's a shame that we can't just reschedule cricket games like that, but the league is a bit funny about rescheduling. It is in whole, it doesn't mind you moving it a day, but it doesn't like you moving it much more than that.
Oh, interesting. I'm not sure we're allowed to move it anywhere, but I'm interested in what's going on with our second team. The team they've just jumped for second place, I think, have recently got into trouble over umpires, because our league is weird. You can either provide your own or pay for panel umpires. And a lot of teams think, well, we'll provide our own because we're more likely to get things go our way like that and we don't have to pay for them. But if teams complain about your umpires too many times, you get auto-assigned panel umpires and you have to pay for them. I noticed the team above us, no comment as to why, has gone from providing their own umpire quite a bit to now having exclusively panel umpires sent their way. I wonder whether there's an opening there for us with some slightly unfavourable decisions.
we tried this with we tried this when we same idea in our league, and we tried it with a guy. I won't say his name. I nearly said his name then, but he was essentially our team drunk. And he was one of the worst umpires I've ever seen. I mean, I've seen people play forward defensives off the middle of the bat and be given out LBW. I've seen people leave a ball and be given out caught behind. And to be honest with you, when it gets to sort of 6 or 7 o'clock and the pubs, you know, were starting to open, he was you were out no matter what happened. It was amazing, yep. Really. You would just get like the back end of the second innings would be like LBW caught behind LBW, it'd be game over, that'd be it. He'd walk off, he collected something like 12 quid or something he wanted for doing it, and that was it. But yeah, he was awful, man. He was drinking cans of lager on the side of the pitch at half time. It was, yeah, not proper cricket.
No, not proper cricket. They don't do these kind of things in Yorkshire these days. Back when you were playing, maybe. But anyway, enough about promotion and relegation in the Chilwell Cricket League. Should we talk about promotion and relegation elsewhere, Steve? You see what I did there? Okay.
Very good. Let's go.
Let's talk about the latest FTSE reshuffle. So every quarter, pretty much, the FTSE 100 is reset, or if needs be, reset to include the roughly 100 largest companies by market cap. It's not quite as specific as that. We'll get into the details in a bit. So some things go out, some things come in. Same goes on with the 250, but I haven't written down which things are going out with the 250 out the bottom. So let's talk about things that are in and out of the FTSE 100 then, because there's 4 coming in from below and 4 going out from the top, from what I can see of it. So the things going out are a company called Hiscox, a company called Johnson Matthey, who make catalytic converters, a company we've mentioned a few times called Persimmon, and something called Aberdeen, I think, which is like Aberdeen, but with only the first vowel, because they thought they'd take out all the vowels, but then forgot the one at the beginning, or something like that, anyway. And coming in is retailer, M&S. They're back in, I think. They've been a FTSE 100 company before. The next two are definitely returning, which is Hikma Pharmaceuticals and Dechra Pharmaceuticals. And I don't know if Diploma has before, but it's one that I've talked about before on this. Not aware that it has, but Diploma also makes it into the FTSE 100 here. Probably no surprise to hear that the 4 that have left the index have had bad years to date in terms of share price. The 4 that are coming in have had decent years to date in share price. It's not as simple as the worst performing go out, the best performing come in, because if you have a massive market cap, if you have an AstraZeneca market cap, you get cut in half and you'll still stay in. But anyway, Steve, any thoughts on any of these?
Not massively. I mean, we like Diploma. That's interesting to see that going into the FTSE 100. I don't know an awful lot about Dechra and Hikma. I couldn't tell you what their products are. I always sort of acutely aware of seeing them at the bottom of the FTSE 100 or the top of the FTSE 250. They're one of the first ones you kind of come across. Persimmon's had a really bad year, and probably not through their own fault. So it's not particularly a shock to see them falling down. But M&S coming back up, Steve. Something of a bit of a resurgent. They're a bit of a sort of a doom and gloom, boom and bust sort of company, aren't they? M&S, they go through stages of you know, doing really well and doing not so well. So it is interesting to see that they're doing pretty well, up 75% this year. Comparing that to Next is only up 17% this year. So that's still great.
That's still pretty good, yeah.
It's amazing, yeah. But yeah, incredible performance from M&S. What they'll do now, Steve, is what always happens to them is they'll lose their CEO, they'll hire the wrong CEO, and they'll be back in the 250 in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, so Dechra is an interesting one. Pharmaceuticals company, and I've no interest in trying to tell you what they do. I think they're generics-y stuff, actually, but the reason that I'm interested in them suddenly showing back up in there is they're up 45%. Since the start of the year, most of that very, very recently, because I believe they've agreed or are very close to agreeing a deal to be acquired. And when things agree deals to be acquired, oftentimes that's higher than their share price. So their share price goes up, which means their market cap goes up, which might be what's actually dragging them back up into the 100. So the stuff I was reading said they're in the 100, but they might not be there long. They might not be anywhere very long. They're set to be acquired at, I think the number I read was 3875. That's in pence, so £38.75. Their current share price is £38.13. There's room there for some arbitrage if anyone's interested in that. There's you know, a few percent to be had from that if anyone's interested, but that's the main story behind Dekra at the moment, I think.
Dekra, just looking to see, Dekra is vet medicine, vet pharma, and Hikma is the generic one, so maybe you've got them the wrong way around. Is it Hikma that's getting acquired, or is it Dekra?
I'm fairly sure it's Dekra that's getting acquired. Why don't you go and Google which one's getting acquired while I talk about M&S for a moment then in that case. M&S is, you called it boom and bust. I very much call it boom, and by which I mean boomers. And I tend to think every so often, how long can this kind of dinosaur thing persist for carrying on? I believe they're kind of the main customer tie-up with Ocado, who I was sort of surprised to not see in this list, because in the last reshuffle 3 months ago, which feels like about 3 weeks ago, they were dangling on the edge of the relegation zone, and people were comparing them to, who was it, Everton, that got clear in the Premier League, because apparently the football season only ended like 2.5 months ago or something. So they got clear. They're now way up at number 64 in the 100 largest things. A bit of chat about being acquired by somebody. Rumours it was Amazon, then Amazon said no thanks, and then it turned out to be a bunch of Italians or something like that, I think. That's helped push Ocado well into safety, and M&S coming into the FTSE 100 with them. Okay, Steve, which one's being acquired? Don't say Hikma, or I'm going to redo this.
I was going to say, Ocado's up 66% in the last six months, so it's having a pretty good time. But yeah, it's Dekra that's being acquired by EQT, Sweden's largest private equity company, apparently.
Mm. That reminds me, by the way, I've been listening to a really good podcast lately. I can't remember where I meant to put this in, but I'll fit it in here. Because Sweden and Norway are basically the same country. Oh, no, they're not. There's a really good podcast run by the person who runs the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. Definitely Norwegian, not Swedish. But he gets CEOs of various companies. They own decent-sized stakes in. We're talking a few billion in these kind of companies, and talks to them and talks about business and how they think about things and their companies and so on. So that their investors, which is roughly speaking the people of Norway, can understand better what they own and how they think about things. And it's really interesting. I thought it was great so far. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund wouldn't have jumped out at me as a place to go looking for podcast stuff, but I thought it was really, really interesting, the ones I've seen. I listened to James Quincy from Coke, Michael O'Leary from Ryanair, in the process of listening to the David Solomon from Goldman, and it also started playing the guy from ExxonMobil, whose name I can't remember, but he sounds like someone who gets oil out of Texas.
What's it called, Steve?
In Good Company is what it's called. The name of the podcast. It's took me a moment to remember that, but it's really good.
It's a good name, that as well. Good name.
It's a good name. It's a quite nicely done podcast, to be honest. Probably almost better than listening to Jamie from Stocks and Savings. Almost. But not quite. So let's carry on with this for a moment then. On the outside, Steve, or on the ones going out, Persimmon's a name that kind of jumps out at me a little bit. I know they've had a rotten year. House builders in general have. But they seem to be getting it worse than everybody else. I know they were heavily exposed to the Help to Buy stuff, which is kind of ending. They have a lower average selling price than most of the other builders, as far as I can tell. The FTSE 250 is, it's not full of house builders, but there's plenty of house builders in there for them to go and hang out with. Everything I read about Persimmon when I try to do any research on them, and it's quite hard to write this in like a Motley Fool article, says they have a reputation for building rubbish houses. I don't want to write that because I feel like I might get into trouble somehow unless I can substantiate it. And I'm not supposed to put external links into those articles because people surf away and don't come back. So any truth to that idea, Steve? I mean, my sister-in-law and family live in a Persimmon house that they had some teething issues with. But I sort of feel like teething issues are nothing terribly unusual in the building industry.
They're not, no. But you are right in that Persimmon are not known for quality, is what I would say. And we know that as it's really tricky for me to say this. Got to be careful a little bit, but as an industry, they are known for it doesn't matter what you think is the right solution, it needs to be the cheapest solution. And if that means that when they get the product on site, they have to drill 160 holes in it to make your plumbing system work, then they'll do that, even if, you know, and then they'll ring you up and say, oh, we've compromised the integrity of the floor by drilling 160 holes in it. We need you to come out and put some sticking plasters on it and make it work again for us. The reason they've fallen so much, Steve, is a simple simple bit of maths for you. They build the most houses. Build the most houses. They've got the most to lose here. And you know, you've seen that in the share price. Houses are selling, but they're selling very slowly. When you were selling two or three a week, you might only be selling one a fortnight now. So it's definitely a really, really slow sales cycle. And they've got the furthest to fall. In personal news, Steve, two viewings on my mum and dad's house.
Excellent. So encouraging stuff.
Maybe it's picking up a bit. They're from Croydon, of all the places in the world. So they'll be selling probably, a two-bed terrace for about 1.5 million.
Yes, and then buying several houses like your parents' house.
Yeah, buying four-bed mansions in whole suburbs and still having probably a million and a bit spare. So very interesting.
That is impressive. I'm fascinated by that fact that Persimmon build the most houses. Everywhere I look, just kind of driving around in Oxford, which I don't do very often, cycling around in Oxford like we do over here, because it's very difficult to get a car anywhere. Firstly, there is no building because there's no space to build anything. But where there is building work going on, like near my parents and so on, just down the road, it mostly appears to be Barratt who are doing all of this kind of stuff. So I'm fascinated. I haven't seen a Persimmon development round here lately. I'm sure there are some, but I wonder whether people are just slightly wise to the idea of signing up for their stuff at the moment. But yeah.
Well, they've got Oxfordshire, they've got sites in Banbury, Bicester, Thame, Wantage.
That's pronounced Bister.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wantage.
Oh,
Whitney,
wow, here we go.
And Chinner.
Northern man pronounces posh parts of the country. Oh, Wantage is posh, actually. Okay, so Wantage is the nearest of those to me. Same as you
How
call
do you get
it,
Bister from Bicester?
I don't know. I like Bicester as well, but I've known for years it was Bister. We went there when I was very little. Yeah. Banbury is right at the north of the county.
Yeah, I know Banbury.
Bister is up there as well, actually. It's just slightly short of Banbury from where we are. Wantage is south, and that, I suppose, if I was guessing, Wantage might have been an idea for where I would have seen them. Tame is towards Aylesbury, so that's out the east, and that, I don't know much about Tame, but I'm sort of surprised by that, I guess. Whitney, I'm not surprised by. Everyone's building everything in Whitney, as far as I can tell.
Compare this to... this is probably why you're not seeing so much of it, Steve. Compare this to just West Yorkshire. They're in Bradford, Castleford, Dewsbury, Flockton, Huddersfield, Keighley, Kippax, Leeds, Morley, Sherburn and Elmet, Wakefield, Rothwell, Netherton and Gaff. That's just West Yorkshire. So there's one, two, three, four,
say,
five.
Is there anywhere else in West Yorkshire?
That is probably all of it. So there's four in South Yorkshire, 11 in North Yorkshire, one in East Yorkshire, four in East Riding of Yorkshire, which is the same place. I don't know why they've split them up, and one in Cleveland as well. So they must have 30 or 40 sites just in Yorkshire alone. God's own country, innit? So you would want to build a lot there.
Probably helps explain why their average selling price is lower than everybody else's, right? If you build most of your stuff in West Yorkshire and less of your stuff in Oxfordshire, the prices tend to be lower for what you sell them for. I imagine it costs less to acquire land there as well. But
yeah, that actually checks out as well. I'm just looking now, County Durham, there's probably 15, 16 in County Durham. There's 10 in Tyne and Wear. There's 6 in Northumberland, 3 in Teesside. So yeah, they're building a lot of, but there's a lot more space up north, so it's not as congested.
There is a lot more space up north. It's quite congested in Bicester at the moment with everyone else.
I can imagine it is, with its stupid name.
Back to the putsy stuff for the moment. This is who says we haven't got stuff to talk about here? Stuff that's dangling on the edge, by the way, of looking at promotion for next time or relegation for next time. Howden Joinery Group, which they definitely don't make low quality stuff. They fitted our kitchen or built our kitchen or designed our kitchen or whatever, and we had someone fit it from trade. They're 94th, which doesn't get them in yet. You have to get above 90 to be auto entry, or fall below 110 to be auto kicked out. But they are in line if anything does drop below. A company called Intermediate Capital, who I know absolutely nothing about, and Games Workshop, favourite of a lot of people on the Discord. Intermediate Capital at 97, Game Workshop at 103. So either of those are in line to make their way in if anything drops. And what might drop? Well, not an awful lot here, but there's something called RS Group, which I don't know very well. But then there's Hargreaves Lansdown, which we've talked about several times on this show. That's at 101, so there's scope for that to move down and fall out. They're busy turning around their management team at the moment, and I suppose eventually looking to try and turn around their business. But that's okay. I thought M&S was a kind of old boomer type business. Hargreaves Lansdown definitely is. And Fraser's Group, which is Mike Ashley's organisation, they're at number 100. That's slightly deceptive in the sense that they've been making their way up from sort of 150 or so. And yes, they are in only just in the FTSE 100, but that's not because they're coming downwards like Hargreaves is. They're working their way up, just they haven't worked their way up far enough yet. Last I saw with Fraser's, they were busy buying stakes in like everything on the high street, as far as I could tell. Like buying
everything
market
that's
shares.
Going bust. Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. They just want to own all the retail stuff, and I'm not sure what their kind of plan to do with it is, but I'm curious to find that out. There's a guy called Andrew Hollingsworth who I follow and look at occasionally with his stuff. He's quite bullish on Fraser's, and he points out with some justification that Mike Ashley does love a bargain cheap, I say bargain, let's just say cheap for the moment, deal on something, anything, like acquiring sofas.com for a quid. Those sorts of things, and then working out where he can kind of do something with them, anything with them. So I keep meaning to look into those a bit more carefully, but then the market goes down and I buy more obvious things instead. But Fraser's is one that catches my eye, I guess, working its way upwards.
Yeah, he's it's strange, really, isn't it, how Ashley can take businesses that other people can't seem to make to work, and he seems to, well, he either makes them work or he's either supplementing them with money from his other companies that do work, his Sports Direct. But that's not a group, Steve, that I'm particularly excited about. I know there's quite a few people who are reasonably bullish on it, and it has shown relatively decent growth recently, considering the acquisitions. It's probably not as organic as you think it is, but it's maybe not the business where you would care about that so much, really. But am I interested in it? I don't know. I think it's a bit like some of the companies you look at in America where they're a conglomerate of shit brands. And that's kind of how I feel about Sports Direct or whatever it's called now, Fraser's Group.
Yep. The brand strength isn't there. The Investor Way podcast, I disagree with them on an awful lot of stuff, but I think they had this right where they thought at first sight that the brand stuff isn't really there in most cases. Do you care very deeply about kind of Lonsdale or whatever for trackies and so on? I think they're much better on stuff that is broadly speaking commoditized. I buy clothes in Sports Direct because I think they are likely to be cheaper than anywhere else I can find them. I don't buy stuff that I view as non-commoditized, like say cricket stuff from there, unless I really can't help it. I bought some boots there because my ones literally, I lost them and I had to go and get some from somewhere and they were the nearest place I could go. But generally speaking, if it's not a kind of commodity like cricket bats or specialist equipment or something, I tend to stay well away. Don't mind buying T-shirts or whatever from there. The ones I'm not buying from, obviously, the plain FTSE T-Mill store.
I don't think I've bought anything from Sports Direct in a very long time, to be honest
with
you.
That's a worry, right? I feel like your end of the country ought to be their kind of target market, right?
What, just Greggs and Sports Direct? Is that all you think about, Steve?
No, you have a Swedish bank and some other things too. But yeah, pretty much those sorts of things. Greg's Sports Direct, some open mines, some cheap houses.
Whippets everywhere.
What else is there? Yeah, probably those too. Yes, anyway, do you have a tram in Hull?
No tram.
Enough of the FTSE ins and outs for the time being. Let's talk about something slightly different for a moment. We'll get to the stocks in just a second, but Brian Feroldi this week, who once appeared on our show, has published on either Instagram or Twitter or some other social media thing a list
LinkedIn.
Of 38 investing... LinkedIn. No wonder I didn't see it. It may as well have been on Instagram or Twitter or X, sorry, or whatever. I'm not even on LinkedIn, by the way. Back to that in another day. Brian Feroldi has published on LinkedIn his list of 38 investing lessons that he has learned, or maybe the 38 most important, but certainly 38 that he personally has learned. They're not necessarily considered to be for everybody, but things he feels he's learned over his investing career. As you can tell, I did not find this. Steve did. And Steve put it on the Trading 212 forum, and it was very exciting. You got some good chat there, Steve, going on. Lots of people with lots of different ideas. I've picked out some that are my favourites, and Steve's got some of his own, I think, that we thought kind of stood out to us as either particularly curious or particularly insightful or particularly worth discussing here. Steve, what was on your what caught your eye here?
Well, I'll read them, Steve, and you tell me where to stop. Right, and then we can talk about the ones before it as well. So number one was, you're going to be wrong a lot. And this one This one's a little bit of a funny one for me because you don't want to be wrong a lot. You want to be wrong sometimes, but the aim is to be wrong as little as possible. So being wrong a lot is probably not a good thing. But maybe in the way that Brian Feraldi invests, this one works out a little bit more. It's more suitable to him. But if you want to build wealth, you have to invest, was number two. Three, humans are pre-programmed to be bad at investing. I think we could probably do this one. If we can find somebody who wants to come and talk investing psychology with us, Steve, this might be a great one to touch upon. But four, confidence in your strategy will rise and fall in lockstep with asset prices. This is true. I think this is true. You can feel like the biggest idiot in the room sometimes, and you can feel really smart. Five, history and psychology are the most important subjects for investors to study.
Yeah, that one jumped out at me, actually. Five, history and psychology. I think that might be true, but I wouldn't lump all of history and all of psychology together. I have half a degree in history. My undergrad was history and philosophy. I don't think that was any real use to me in my investing life. It's not been massive amounts of use to me since. I probably should have done a better job at it. But I think, yeah, not knowing what happens based on the history of interest rates or whatever is going to lead to you getting hurt quite a bit. Understanding how people think is incredibly helpful. I wonder whether it's generally true that in whatever enterprise you're in, whether it's investing or cricket or accountancy or whatever, knowing some stuff about the history of that thing is probably kind of useful to you.
Yeah, I agree to a degree there. I think you've nailed it, really. That it's a lot less broad than just saying history and psychology, isn't it? It's like just knowing specifics, really. Six was the best stocks put their owners through gut-wrenching volatility, and the worst stocks do too. Thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think that might be true. I tend to think that the best stocks I own probably, well, in my limited experience, and Feraldi's been investing much longer than me, and he likes different types of investments to me. What do you think the best stock is, Steve? I'll offer you mine, actually. I'll give you, you can have a think for a moment. I think the best stock I own is probably Berkshire Hathaway. That doesn't tend to be heavily volatile, but both Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger say in their times it's been cut in half three times. So I suppose that's probably true here. I can't think of anything that hasn't had a big down. Okay, maybe not while I've owned it, but nonetheless, I think really good businesses do randomly get clobbered.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's very hard to categorize the best stock, isn't it? I think there's some stocks that I'm losing money on that I still look at and think, well, these are fantastic businesses. Do you know what I mean? And they maybe I am being put through the volatility, but I experienced that a lot last year with a lot of the stocks that have gone on to be big winners in the capital incinerator falling 60%, 70%, 80%, 90%, and then, you know, making it back in a year and a bit. It is kind of crazy, but so number seven was handle volatility in theory. I'm guessing he means handling volatility in theory is 100x easier than handling volatility in reality, and I think that is one of those things that's true. Everybody has the highest risk tolerance in the world until they see their 20 grand become 10 grand in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, and it's generally not the case these things happen randomly, is it? I mean, they see 20 grand become 10 grand because something's happened at the company. And maybe it's a big market overreaction. Maybe it's not worth that drop. But it's hard to see, okay, well when is Meta going to stop incinerating cash or whatever, for one example of a recent drop? When is Netflix ever going to, hang on, wait, Netflix's users are slowing down. Oh, this is a problem, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, especially when the news cycle sort of picks up on it as well, because you just get bombarded with it, especially because, you know, you read one and the algorithm goes, he obviously likes to hear news about how bad Netflix is, and just keeps feeding you again and again and again. But no amount of words can explain what a 30% drop feels like. I think this is pretty much linked to soft seven and six, really. A 30% drop is pretty nasty, especially in a day. It doesn't feel particularly good. M-Phase was one that we both went through, Stephen. That was a pretty bad day for us, wasn't it?
Yeah, currently the worst performing stock in the S&P 500 year to date, I think.
Yeah.
Down there with SolarEdge.
Your personal finances are 10 times more important than your investments. Now, I would caveat this one by saying definitely at the beginning, but as the investment pot grows, it becomes vastly more important. But yeah, definitely when you're starting. I'm not sure that's an investing lesson that you'd learned the hard way, though.
No, I hope it isn't. I feel like when you learn that the hard way, it means that something has gone really wrong and that you didn't have cash there to cover it, which is that's just bad for everybody, right? So yeah, I hope not.
Number 10 was successful investing requires an uncomfortable mix of pessimism and optimism, which is damn hard for our brains to handle.
Quite a lot in that one, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think that's fair enough, isn't it? I think there's that the Buffett has probably given you an easy one in this, which is just having a too hard pile and no pile, you know, and saying no to almost everything, isn't it? But being optimistic in, you know, America's ability to create wealth.
Before we move on, a quick one from Steve and me. If you're enjoying the show, please do give us a like, a comment, and a rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And make sure you share the podcast with your investing friends. It helps us a lot, and we're really looking forward to building out something that you guys can get some value from and that we can have some fun in making. So do like, subscribe, and back on with the show.
The sucker's going up.
Yeah, I mean, an uncomfortable mix of pessimism and optimism. I'm sort of interested in that. I get that it needs a balance, right? And that people want to see the... And look, if you buy something and you invest in something, it is probably because you thought the optimist argument wins over the pessimist argument. And that's fine, might be correct. And likewise, the other way around. I don't know. I feel like I don't find myself terribly kind of uncomfortable here. It requires both. And it requires you to not just ignore a load of counter arguments, because otherwise you end up owning Intel and insisting that there's no danger coming when there clearly is, and all your profits disappear. Likewise, you can't be kind of just ragingly pessimistic about anything, or you'll never buy stuff.
Yeah, you'll end up in a money market fund for a long time, and that won't do you a lot of good. I always sort of like to sort of stick to the optimistic side of it, because the market goes up a lot more than it goes down. So if you're optimistic, you tend to win, you know, more than you lose. So,
right. If you're over-optimistic, you do better than if you're over-pessimistic, is the thought.
Yeah, yeah. So 11 was 99% of investors should dollar cost average into index funds and call it a day.
I had a long chat with Anathema about this on Trading 212. I'll roughly summarise at least my side of this, and I think Anathema was quite sympathetic, to be honest. But my thought was that, look, if you think the market is going to perform average, by almost by definition here, maybe let's say slightly under, because if you dollar cost average into it, you will pay fees along the way. But let's say average for the moment. I'm not sure how 99% of people can be better off by being average. It doesn't seem like much of an average if 99% of people are underneath it, basically. It seems like something doesn't quite sit right in my brain there. And I did wonder, though, whether what that point really means is that 99% of people, the amount of time they will need to put in to outperform the market, they won't get back in returns, right? So if you got an extra, I don't know, 0.5% a year, but you had to think about investing for 4 hours a day every day, is it worth it to you? No, you probably should have spent those other 4 hours going off and doing something else, getting paid for doing that other thing, and just put more in to get your market return again. So I see some truth there. But the idea that if you think sort of half the world dollar cost averages into a market, okay, they come out average. Well, so the remaining half of the world must by definition come out average as well, because that's what the average is here between them. So some of them will be above, some of them will be below, not necessarily even split between them. But I struggle with the idea that how 99% of people in terms of just returns are going to be somehow below average. But that caught my attention as interesting. Yeah.
How is 99% of people investing into, say, the S&P not a Ponzi scheme, though? That's kind of, when you think about it, as literally as that is just the new people putting in money and the old people taking it out, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah, just back population growth and assume there'll be more money kicking around in future, which is kind of that's pretty much exactly what a Ponzi scheme is. Yeah,
you don't want stock prices tagged to population growth, though. Oh.
No.
So 12, graduate school taught me a lot of complex calculations that only work in theory. I think that one's pretty straightforward.
Probably true. I sort of pithily think he should have gone to a better graduate school, but it's his lesson. You know, if he says that's what it taught him, then who am I to argue?
So 13 was bear markets happen fast and bull markets happen slowly. That's been not true for people who've been in the last, true and not true, in people who've been investing about 3 or 4 years, because the COVID bull market was absolutely bonkers. But the bear market that came after it was about a year long, and it felt pretty quick how fast things fell. So true and not true. Probably true going forward, though.
Hopefully. I'd like a long-running bull market here. I mean, it's true. It's been true, but I mean, those of us who aren't old enough maybe overlook kind of grinding lengthy recessions and lost decades and that kind of thing. We will see on that one, I think. If you're thinking bear market as in stuff going down, I don't think it will kind of indefinitely. If you think, though, lousy returns and underperformance or something, then I can see that lasting a while. But yeah, okay.
14, consistently avoiding ruin is the most underrated financial skill. I think that probably speaks for itself to some degree.
Probably, yeah.
15, the biggest factor that will impact your returns is your holding period. I think this one's pretty true for me, Steve.
I think that's true as well. I think that it's definitely the case that I probably would have reversed that with the last one and said, here's an underrated thing for boosting your returns, increase your holding period, or something like that. I'm always wary of these kind of most ones. By the way, also consistently avoiding financial ruin. Another one that goes into the bucket of hope he didn't learn it the hard way with these things. But yeah.
That's something Buffett has said. It's his rule number one, isn't it? Don't lose money. Don't.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we're just going to say the holding period is something that's actually been declining over the last couple of decades. We've gone from I think it was 3 or 4 years to most people only holding a matter of months. So it's definitely something that we could probably improve on. 16, losing money hurts 3 times more than making money feels good. I think this one is a pretty common known psychology trait. So I won't spend any time on it. 17, make more, spend less, invest simply, and wait longer is the best financial advice there is. Probably shouldn't comment on this one, Steve. We're not allowed to give it.
No. Someone else might financially advise you that, though.
18, how to time the market is only obvious in hindsight. Frauds are only obvious in hindsight, and bad investments are only obvious in hindsight. I think that's probably true. It's what we always say about rearview mirrors selling out. Steve, on things like Adyen, there is a lot of, if you ever read a book called The Signs Were There, I recommended it to Anathema again, actually. He's getting double mention this week, and I don't think he even listens to the podcast, but yeah, I recommended it to him as a book of spotting out when things are starting to go wrong in a business. And it's all written in hindsight, but written from the point of view of, look at the balance sheet at this time. This is what you should have spotted. And it's a really fantastic book. So I think it's by Tim Steer. The Signs Were There. That's a recommendation for that one.
I think this is sometimes true. I think it's true when you have a bad investment because your company turns out to be Wirecard or something. How someone is supposed to see that beforehand, don't know. I think there are some obvious stock market frauds kicking around, though. And I think there are some obvious terrible ideas kicking around too. In some cases, maybe there's. That's. I'm trying not to confuse here being right about something, which is basically a coin flip, right? You think that vertical takeoff EVs or whatever they are going to be great. I think they're going to be terrible. One of us is going to be right. One of us is going to be wrong. And one of us will say, therefore, it was easy, or something like that. But I do feel like kind of EV tolls are an obviously terrible thing. But we'll see.
Yeah, The Money Men by Dan McCrum. There's another book recommendation for people who think about Wirecard in that way. And to be fair to the FT, they've been shouting about it for about 4 or 5 years before it actually collapsed, and they were getting sued and told they were idiots, and the stock price kept going up and up and up. I think about €9, they were saying it was absolutely garbage, and I think Wirecard got up to about €100, so... There you go. 19, great investments are only obvious in hindsight. I guess this is very much what we think about the one before, really. It's, yeah, maybe. I think sometimes you can spot them, though. I think there's times when you're looking at, like, Netflix, whatever it got down to $180, and you can think, it doesn't have to do an awful lot right here to improve in price. Or Meta, when Meta got down to about 11p or 10p, and thinking, well, Meta doesn't have to do an awful lot here to do well for you. Anything on it, Steve?
Yeah, you don't have to think it's obvious necessarily, I think, but you shouldn't be thinking, well, don't know whether this will be good or bad, money go in, and so on, because I won't know until the hindsight stuff kicks in. obvious is maybe a bit of a reach in some cases, but it does look like there are some good investments are easier to spot than others, at least. I mean, presumably, I think now. Otherwise, why am I buying the ones that I'm buying and not other ones?
Fair enough. To make money quickly, number 20, concentrate your portfolio with leverage. To destroy money quickly, concentrate your portfolio with leverage. Really hope this isn't one he had to learn the hard way, because that sounds expensive.
Yeah, it's true, though. That's basically what leverage does. Makes things bigger, whether you kind of gain or lose.
Yeah. 21, selling a mega winner early is the most expensive investing mistake you can make. I'm quite guilty of this sometimes, Steve. I work on a 10% return, and if something makes a 15 or 20% return really, really quickly, and I struggle to see the upside from there, I can quite happily cut it off. I did it with Albemarle. It made about 45% return, and then it proceeded to go up about 200% in the next 6 months.
I also did it with Albemarle, probably did it with Enphase, but I didn't sell it at the time it was winning. I've done it with various things at various different points in the past. Is it the most expensive mistake? Don't know. It's clearly a bad one.
22. A business and its stocks can become detached from each other for years. You see this a lot. I think this is a fairly obvious one.
Yep, I agree.
23. Whatever happened over the last 12 months will have a massive impact on what you think will happen over the next 12 months. We see this a lot coming out of the bear market. There's still people who are really, really, really bearish and have been calling for a recession all year. And we actually might be seeing the signs of a recession coming, Steve, but I think my prediction will be all right for now. I don't think it's going to happen before the end of the year, so I'll pop the champagne on that one. But yeah, definitely people... Yeah, people use sort of relative history more than you know, less relative history.
Yeah, connected to your the previous thought about history being one of the most important subjects, right? Everyone can remember what happened in the last year, but your data set shouldn't be what happened in the last year. Humans will naturally lean hard on the recency stuff, but this speaks to his thought about, look, you need to know history stuff.
Yeah. 24, the market is under no obligation to provide you with the returns you need in the time frame that you need it to. Yeah, this one's obvious as well, and it sort of leans on that when people say, oh, I've got a house, I'm buying a house next year, and I want to put it in the S&P and get my 9%. It's like, that is very unlikely. That's so risky. Don't do that. That seems stupid.
It's absolutely not the way that works. No. Yeah. The market is what it is, right? Your job is to look after you in the market. Everybody else's job is to look after them in the market. They don't owe you anything, basically. And you don't owe them anything either, right? You never have to, unless something goes wrong in your personal life. But there is no stock market related reason why you have to sell your assets to anyone at any given point. You don't have to buy theirs at any given point. It's entirely up to you, but it's also entirely up to them.
25, there will always be a huge demand for forecasts, regardless of past accuracy. Oh, God, we know this one. This is an obvious one.
Why do you think we have a show?
Yeah, 26, tied to this one. Analysts have huge pressure on them to issue bullish ratings on stocks. I think we've whinged about this before today as well, Steve.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. They absolutely do have a pressure on them to issue bullish ratings on things because they want people to do stuff, because that's how fees get paid.
27, the desire to hold a loser until you get back to even is incredibly strong. I think this is one that I know you've told me off about this before, Steve. If you
told me off about it before too.
Yeah, true. If you've got a better opportunity, stop waiting for Teladoc and what have you to come back. Teladoc was never coming back, I don't think.
No, but I mean, certainly in my case as well, I kind of began with a straightforward of, look, here's how I'm not going to lose money. If something goes down, I'm just going to hold it until it comes back again. That, by the way, if it works, if you do that, you will never realize a loss, because you will never sell anything in the red. You will either have a portfolio that's massively down, but it will be unrealized, or you'll be doing fine. The trouble with that is, the more I look at stuff, I think, okay, I think this is a really good investment opportunity at today's prices. I like it better than I like this other thing. The fact that I bought the other thing, I don't know, 20% higher than it is now or whatever, okay, so I should sit here and wait for it, but that thing may be gone by that point. The question is, what's the best thing for me to do right now? Cut the loser and get on with it.
I think so too.
That does incidentally speak to his, we haven't got to that one yet. Carry on.
I mean, I've read it's a legitimate strategy, just to add to that. It is a legitimate strategy just to stop adding to losers. That's basically what the Motley Fool were. They just penalty box things that have lost money and don't add to them unless they see a significant reason to do so. But I think I'm more in favour of cutting something I got wrong and putting that money to better use. Mm. 28. Panic selling once can destroy years of good investment decisions in seconds. I think that's a fairly obvious one for me.
Absolutely, yes. And so can being forced out of something by getting your personal finances wrong.
Hmm. 29. Interest rates matter a lot. I think a lot of people probably wouldn't have thought about this one too much over the last 12 years, Steve, but we're definitely seeing that happening now.
It appears that they are the single biggest thing that matters for stocks in general. I think interest rates going up means that people want better returns from stocks, means prices come down. Yeah, interest rates really do matter. And when they start going up and people start thinking they're going to go higher, we get real downward pressure. Equally, the other way around, when people are expecting this Fed pause or pivot or whatever else they're meant to be doing, we start seeing enthusiasm and optimism flooding back in to the stock market. So yeah, interest rates absolutely do matter. I'm prepared to believe as well, based on the stuff that he says he owns, this is something Brian Feroldi learned the hard way over the last couple of years or so.
Stocks, this is number 30. Stocks won't make you wealthy if your behavior is wrong. I think this is a pretty obvious one. 31, trimming winners and doubling down on losers is a terrible strategy. The opposite works much better. Steve, this is one of yours on your hit list, I believe.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It depends a bit on what you mean by winners and losers here a little bit. I mean, on the one hand, when I think about this, here's a basic strategy for stock market participation. Buy stuff when it's low, sell stuff when it's high. And if by losers you mean things that are low and winners you mean things that are high, well, this is the opposite of that in that situation. So if you have an S&P type tracker thing and you want to try and rebalance yourself and you want to say, well, look, the issue with a tracker is that it buys the stuff that goes up and it sells the stuff that goes down. I'm not sure about this. I mean, if you mean winning and losing businesses, by the way, then yeah, that probably is a bad strategy. It's one I'm absolutely guilty of on the trimming winners side businesses. I see businesses growing and think, cool, how much longer are they going to do that? Don't know, sell them. I don't tend to double down into businesses where earnings are getting worse necessarily, or their deterioration going on there. But I'm interested in winners and losers here a little bit. This is connected to the thought, I suppose, of waiting to get back to even on a quote unquote loser.
Yeah, I think my thoughts on this are pretty similar to you. I think it depends is how I would say to this. If you're just selling your best performing stock to put it into your worst performing stock on the basis of that this one is up the most and this one is down the most, then that's probably not a very good idea. But this is obviously the caveat that Feroldi is of Motley Fool background and they believe in pulling the weeds and watering the flowers kind of thing. So this is essentially a more wordy version of that. 32, Steve. Market sectors go in and out of fashion all the time and sometimes for years. We've seen this with oil and gas in the last couple of years. We've seen this with even shipping came in for a little bit over the last couple of years with a 375% dividends or whatever they were, and then you lost 99% of the share price.
Yeah, it's fascinating when this happens, that things come in and out of fashion. The other thing that fascinates me is that people get very tempted to say that things that are obviously cyclical are no longer cyclical. And what they mean is they're at the top of their cycle. Usually, because at the top of the cycle, things are generally characterized by optimism, saying, see, great, so this will carry on forever because now this has to carry on forever. And no, it won't. It will go down again like it did last time, and then it'll come back again like it did last time. And these are cyclical things. I'm not sure there's anything that's ever entirely immune from this kind of stuff, even the kind of consumer staplesy businesses that you might come to here. Even utilities actually come in and out of fashion as well. We've been seeing that a fair bit lately. Utilities are well down this year for dividend investors who are interested in getting involved there. So, yep, I agree with that very, very strongly in my case.
Bear markets are great news for long-term buyers, but 90% of people will freak out when they occur. I think this one's pretty obvious. If you hang around the Trading 212 community, you'll see that people, the minute prices go down a couple of percent, people are like, is this the recession? But you really like people who, like, say, I've been here 2 weeks and my stocks are down 10%. am I just rubbish at it? And you think, well, no, these are just opportunities. If you've researched these companies and you think they're the right companies, then at 10% down, you should be absolutely over moon this early on in your investing career, because that's a really great thing. We see it as well, Steve, with YouTube creators. Some of our favorite YouTube creators, Steve, who we watched a lot, have disappeared off the face of the earth, and others who have done like top 10, 10x stocks for the next 10 years, with nearly all of them down between 30 and 90%. They just delete the videos, Steve, and pretend it never happened.
Yep. Yeah, we don't do that. I tend to just stick to stuff that's down, but I don't mind bear markets at the moment. I feel like I don't want to sell anything. I haven't got anything I want to buy other than more stocks. The real issue for me isn't running away from a bear market. It's getting tempted to fiddle around and do stuff that I shouldn't do within my portfolio rather than drawing it down.
The problem with running a numeric sequence, Steve, is that we can't delete all the videos where we we said something was good. If you ever go onto our
video, is no number between 32 and 34.
Yeah, what do you mean? Right. 34, being greedy when others are fearful is really, really hard. Join the bear market, Steve. I did think this, actually. There were times when I had a bit of cash, you know, not massive amounts, but, you know, 1,000, 1,500 quid. And I just kept saying, maybe if it goes a little bit lower. And I did it with NVIDIA. I think NVIDIA, I wanted 120. NVIDIA was 140. In the grand scheme of things, that's not a massive difference in terms of, you know, a fast-growing company like that. And I didn't pull the trigger, Steve, and I missed out on it. And I do that a lot over, you know, 5-10% of, you know, getting towards the pricing. When you're thinking about a fast-growing company, that's maybe too big of a margin of safety on something like that.
I think this is sometimes true for me. I find the opposite way round to that to be much harder. Being fearful when others are greedy, I find much, much, much more difficult. I look at stocks like, I don't own this, haven't owned it, but it's the kind of stock that kind of traps me a little bit. I look at something like a Costco trading at 30-odd times earnings and think, yeah, but it's never cheap, but it never comes down. It never gets below 32 PE or something. And then I buy it, and then it does. And then I think, oh, yeah, people were kind of greedy around that one. I was supposed to be being fearful there. And I find it much, much, much harder to not let myself get talked into buying things that where people are enthusiastic and thinking, yep, there you go, than I do to keep adding to stuff that I own that's down. That, to me, is much I'm terrible at the other end of that, basically. The fearful bit is the bit I need to get better at.
35, it's easy to convince yourself that you are investing when what you are really doing is speculating. I think I see this one quite a lot on the Trading 212 communities. I'm a bit of a pie pervert. When somebody posts something up like, look at my pie, I like to have a look at them on Trading 212, and I often think when I look down
the most northern thing you've ever said.
Yeah,
it might be.
Feels a bit Popeye, doesn't it? But yeah, I do like to look down, and I often think as I get down the list of stocks thinking, I don't think you know an awful lot about these companies. I would be surprised if you did. So yeah, I think that one's pretty true to me.
I think this is true as well. I think probably Feroldi and I think differently about the difference between investing and speculating, which is where I get stuck a little bit. But I'm not sure whether I've convinced myself I was investing in things when I was really speculating. I think I definitely find it easy to get suckered into speculating a bit. I often cite Boston Beer Company as my worst investment, not necessarily because of the amount it cost me, because, you know, as my portfolio grows, I have more money to put into stuff. I would put more in, lose more, potentially. But that wouldn't be a worse job of investing. I think the real issue I have with Boston Beer Company is I was basically speculating. It was not much more than this has gone down a lot. It's going to go up again, right? Because it's cool. And the point about things going in and out of fashion hadn't really dawned on me there. But I can definitely get suckered into speculating. But I think he's definitely right about this. I think this is... I'm fascinated in the idea that this is right in ways that... I think this is true in ways that Feroldi doesn't necessarily, but I definitely agree that it's true with the words that are written.
Fair enough. Agree. 36. The stock market will always attract people who are in a rush to build wealth and build wealth for people who are not in a rush. I think this is one, again, it's a fairly common sort of idea. I got asked the other day, Steve, where is the best place to get signals from? And that really made me think of this point. There is no good place to get signals, because if someone's selling you signals, they're making more money selling the signals than they are from the signals themselves. Either that, or they're trying to create some kind of pump and dump scheme. But yeah, there is a lot of people who think that there's a lot of people, Steve, out there who still believe they can make 30-40% a year for life just by, I'll just make 1% on 40 stocks and that's 40%. And you just think, yeah, that's not how it works.
No, you hear some strange things in this regard, don't you? Like someone said, okay, they were going to just try and take 10% a day around earnings. And obviously that was going to get tricky as the numbers get bigger, because 10% a day is difficult. But they figured that when they got to 1,000, it would be harder to make 10% than when they were investing at 100. Like, it doesn't make the blindest bit of difference at that level. There's nothing that you can't buy with £1,000 that's doing earnings that you could have stuck 100 quid into. But yeah, I genuinely feel the confusion there.
37, do nothing is almost always the right move. I think I've said this one a lot of times. There's a lot of times I feel like I should do something and I look around and I think, you know what? I'm just going to do nothing. It's the best move.
Yeah, it's the issue that we've had. This is too strong, actually, the issue we've had. But one of the things we've always noticed about being able to transact for free, that it encourages you to do things because, well, yeah, what's the cost, right? And you sort of think to yourself, okay, but you have this ability to move in and out of things. That doesn't mean you must avail yourself of this ability that you have. You have the ability to do a lot of things. It doesn't make it smart for you to do them. And yeah, if there was a cost to doing it, would you do it? Maybe less so. If there's no cost to doing it, yeah, okay, I'll sell that thing and buy this other thing, and so on.
It's like you've got that £200 in your account and you're like, ah, oh, I'll just bang it in something. And then if you had like a £13 or £15 charge for doing so, would you do it? I think you'd probably save it up.
I do, in the lifetime ISA, for what it's worth, yeah.
38, this is the last one. When prices are rising, investors wish for a bear market. And when a bear market appears, investors wish for it to end. I think this one's really true, Steve. I see this a lot on Twitter or X or whatever it's called, and the Trading 212 communities. The minute stocks start going down, people are like, oh, please go green again. When it's completely the wrong mentality. A few months, 6-12 months of red is so good for people who are starting out their portfolios. Not so good for people who are towards the end of their investing careers, but I mean, even if you've just got 10 years left of investing, a good long period of bear market is still pretty good to make sure you get better prices.
Yeah, one thing you and I have found is that some of the time when things have been lower, partly because we're early in our investing careers, it's hard to get as much money as you want into a stock to make it a meaningful contribution for the end of your thing. So if you think you're eventually going to end up with a £750,000 portfolio or something like that, and that's where you think you'll end up in 30 years or whatever, and you think, well, okay, I've only got so much of that that I can put in now. What is even 20,000 going to look like at the end of that? If I stuck the whole damn thing into one stock, that would still only be a fraction of it all by the end. And then think we're dealing in the kind of domains of 1,000 and so on. Stuff's got to stay down for long enough for you get money into it, basically. And it's very hard for it to do that. And if you keep wishing it higher, you're going to be faced with one of two choices. One is buy it higher, which you probably shouldn't want to be doing, given a choice between buying it higher and buying it lower. And the other is selling it and going to find something else. But of course, that's work. You now have to go and find another thing you want to go and buy.
Yeah, and it's just not always there to find, is it? That's the thing. It's just not always It's just not always available. So, Steve, we're at the hour mark.
We are at the hour mark, and we talked about mostly principal things.
Yeah. Do you have time to do Bunzl and MongoDB?
What do you think? We could probably hold it there, I guess, and come back to that. Bunzl's not something that people click on an awful lot. It gets very low search traffic.
Do you want me to rattle through MongoDB?
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
Okay, so MongoDB, they were up about 5% on the release of this earnings report. This is, I think, their Q2. Market liked it quite a lot. It's up about 150% in the capital incinerator. So I'll have a quick look through the report for you and see what you think. For those who don't know, this is a $30 billion software company, or roughly a $30 billion software company. It specializes in document databases. So a document database is like a filing cabinet where each file can contain different information. So, for example, a file might contain a person's name, age, address, and another file might contain a product's name, price, and description. Document databases are more flexible than a relational databases because they don't require a fixed schema. And this means that the structure of the data can change over time without having to change the database itself. So relational databases are more rigid because they require a fixed schema, and that makes them more difficult to use for storing complex data. So if you think databases are becoming more complex over time, which they almost definitely are, MongoDB is the leader in this segment, and it's used pretty broadly across a number of industries as well. A number of industries, a number of apps. Monzo use it, Steve, as one of their for their document databases. But anyway, revenue came in $424 million. That was up 40% year on year, so pretty strong growth. Atlas, which last time we covered it, Steve, was actually an emerging product for them, is now 63% of revenue. $318 million reported as gross profit. That's about a 75% margin, and unfortunately, that's where the good news ends for value investors. There was $367 million of operating expenses, 46% of revenue spent on sales and marketing, 30% on R&D, and 11% on G&A. I've done it again, Steve. Leading to a gap of operating loss of $49 million and a negative margin of about 12%. As of July 31st, 2023, MongoDB had about $1.9 billion in cash and cash equivalent, short-term investments and restricted cash. During the 3 months ended July 31, 2023, MongoDB used $25.3 million of cash from operations, used $0.6 million of cash in capex, and used $1.4 million of cash in principal repayments and finance leases, leading to negative free cash of $27.3 million compared to negative free cash flow of $48.6 million in the year-ago period. So it's coming down, Steve, but it's still negative. Stock-based comp was up year-on-year, touch over $113 million or 27% of revenue. Was issued this quarter, which is why they're really keen for you to look at the non-GAAP number, Steve. That's just short of $220 million in the last two quarters. So if we're lazy and double it and assume $40 million in SBC costs over the year, that's about 14.5% dilution on share count. It's a touch high, in my opinion, but the growth is strong. So make of that what you will. Some good news though, Steve. Customer numbers up 22% to 45K. Customers spending over 100K was up 27% to 1,855. Guidance was for 20% revenue growth in the next quarter, 109% EPS growth. That's non-GAAP. Both outpacing Wall Street expectations next quarter. Same take on full year guidance, which was revised upwards, 25% growth on the top, 185% growth on the bottom line, again non-GAAP, essentially adding back what they chalked off in the last quarter. So it's not a cheap stock, Steve. I tried to run some valuations on it. It's about 20 times sales, doesn't have a bottom line that we can really discuss. Making assumptions on a free cash flow margin of the future is quite tricky, but at a 20% margin and at 30% growth, this one's pretty overvalued, Steve. If you bump it up to a 30% margin and 30% growth, it does make it look a little bit better, but maybe that's a tad unrealistic. Any interest in this one from you, Steve?
Fascinating business. From what I can tell, they look like they're attempting to get to profitability next year, so they're a year away. They have a forward PE of something like 190-odd, which you said that loss and that outflow from the free cash division was getting smaller. I think it crosses over next year, perhaps, but it's one of those numbers that looks massive and comes down fast, right? I mean, you wouldn't want to be owning a business that was offering you a 0.5% cash return each year, but that will double and double and double. And if you only needs a few kind of years of doubling like that, and it suddenly becomes quite interesting, right? 190 comes down to 90, comes down to 40, comes down to 20. And okay, that's doubling, but it's doubling from a very low base. And I wonder whether they have the kind of scope to be able to get that out of there. The thing that I suppose makes me think this is probably more expensive than I'd want to buy it at, and I think it looks expensive relative to some of these kind of software stocks that we've been talking about over the last few weeks as well, is that price to sales figure. That's going to have to go a lot higher for this. We're talking 30-ish billion market cap, 20 times sales, did you say, roughly? Yep, so I was looking at that and thinking that that revenue needs to punch its way forward a bit. And you said they're looking at about 20% going forward for a bit?
25% is the year.
25% is the year. Okay. That needs to happen. I think this is kind of still slightly enthusiastically priced. It's been a good year for growth stocks, actually. They've been comfortably outperforming both the market and value stocks over in the States. And market liked this report then.
Market liked it, yes, centered up about 5.5%. It's been a very strong performer this year. It's actually had a slightly, the last time we covered it was last quarter, had a slightly down couple of weeks after that, but then has sort of spared on growth from that point onwards. They did revise guidance down at that point. They've basically added it back on in this quarter. 20% growth, Steve, and 20% margin. I say it's overvalued because I'm only working on 10 years, 10 years before I'm hitting a terminal rate there. There's a very high chance that this does a Salesforce sort of thing and grows 20% for 20 years. And then, like all software companies does, eventually becomes a conglomerate of software companies and becomes something better, Steve. But, at this point, are you willing to bet on that? I mean, I am not willing to bet on it. I'm up 150-something percent on it. I'm willing just to sit on this one and let my winners run.
Yeah, I think you could probably get away with doing that quite nicely. The underlying business does look good. It comes down to just sort of price here. But I don't mind that it's not profitable, by the way, just yet. I can see there are good-looking metrics. CapEx looks pretty low, as what I can tell of this, as it often is in the software business, but that's a very good thing to like about it. I can see there's a lot to go for here. It feels to me like there's quite a lot also being priced in. So it's a good business to own. It's a good business to have. Probably a good business to have bought 100 and how many percent ago did you say?
150, if you'd like me to say it again.
Yeah, 150. So you bought it at, we're talking 8 times today's sales, something like that. Something in that kind of area. So that to me seems a lot more sensible, right? I can see how you might well get yourself to a return on the price that you paid on there from the business rather than just from people wanting to buy it off you for more in the style of the Ponzi scheme. But today's prices, it feels like the return there is a long way away, right? Which it is. It's another 100% away.
I seem to think in my head that I bought it under a 10 billion valuation at the time. It's just that it's been that heavily diluted since that point. And the share price has obviously gone up, that it's now at 30 billion valuation and I haven't got all of that gain.
No, you mentioned a 14.5% for the year dilution, which is 25% revenue growth is great. 14% is a drag on that, quite a significant drag on that. But maybe this kind of thing calms down as they start getting cash in. I mean, at the very least, they can offset it partly by buying back with free cash as they start producing it. It'll be a while till they get to offsetting all of that dilution. But if it can keep growing and they can just try and just take away that headwind a little bit, that would be helpful.
Yeah, up 106% year-to-date, Steve, so it's been a straight double this year. Impressive business, though.
I'm looking at its five-year chart. It appears to have, back to the Brian Feroldi point for the moment, it appears to basically be negative correlated to where people's ideas about interest rates are going. So it went up quite a lot to about 20, when interest rates were very, very low in around the sort of 2021, near the start of 2022 period, and came down quite a lot. It came down much lower than I think you probably got it, to be honest. I'm not sure. Maybe it's only about where you looked at it. What's your average price?
Don't know.
Okay, so it came down around the sort of 190 mark, which is, 160 mark, actually, I'm seeing here. Yeah, so you didn't get it there. Did you? Double and half? That's about right. I think
yeah,
you may have
right,
been somewhere
yeah.
near the bottom on this. Yeah, so double for 320, add another 80 for close to 400, which is where it is at the moment. Yeah, you may well have got yourself somewhere near the bottom on this, which is a nice job. Well done.
Just looking, Steve, IPO'd 20th of October 2017 at $30. So it's been just under a 12x in the last 6 years.
Yep, for not people bad. Who were prepared to tough it out.
Yeah, not bad. Really volatile, though. There's been a few swings here of fallen from 420 to 260 and then shot all the way up to nearly 600 and fell all the way down to 160 and now we're back just under 400. So, yeah, back to our original points when we were reading through that. The volatility on this has been horrible, but what a winner.
Yeah, and I assume it's never turned a profit in that time or been free cash positive. It's working its way towards that and so on, and it's had the runway to do that. And when you're looking at kind of companies where you think, even profitability, not ultimate profitability or something, but any kind of profitability is out in the future, you need a fairly smooth sea in terms of interest rates to get you to that point, right? Mm. Good companies with bright futures could be knocked over by suddenly interest rates taking a big whack. And that's where you sort of see this happening, right? The upside, if you can get there, is huge, but the chances of you getting there are much, much lower than something that can self-finance using its own free cash, which I guess is worth looking at here as often the way.
Fair enough.
Any other thoughts on this, Steve, or is that pretty much you?
That was it.
Great. I think we can probably knock stuff off there in that case. We're through an hour and a quarter or so of various things, mostly investing principles this week. But thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time next week